Welcome to episode 130 of the Linux Lugcast. We are an open podcast lug that meets at 9 p.m. Eastern every first and third Friday of the month using Mumble. We encourage anyone that's listening to join us and participate in the podcast. Check out linuxlugcast.com for server details. If you have any questions, comments, or topics you'd like to discuss and are unable to join us at the live show, you can always send us an email at feedback@linuxlugcast.com. You can check out our MeWe community at meWe.com/join/linuxlugcast. Or check us out on IRC on the Freenode server at the Linux Lugcast channel. And I'm Fweeb. Hello. With us tonight we have 5150.
Howdy, folks.
Honky Magoo.
Evening.
Joe Seto.
Hello.
And another Joe. There's two Joes.
No, they're both me.
Oh,
I just use two different computers.
Aha. That's what I get for not paying attention. J-Rulo, with no mic, because I couldn't see that either. And Menix.
Hello.
And Netminer.
Yes, gentlemen. I'm here.
Woo-hoo! We made it through that. All right. And it looks like we did have some feedback on MeWe. Does someone want to run through that?
Yep, it's another... It's another blog post by Crian Matthews. It's about groups of permissions. One second, let me bring it up.
You want me to do it?
I got it. Basically it's just an explanation of users, groups, some permissions, how to set up passwords, add users. He does, I think he does nice work on his blogs. Explaining things.
Well, I'm glad for the link because that's something every time I have to mess with users and groups, and a lot of it is
you got to look it back up for the specifics.
Exactly. Well, a lot of it is these images for SBCs or whatever. You have a default you're given a default user and password. And you want to make, you want to create your own user and how to, how to make your user equivalent to the default user first off. So I haven't looked at this, but I'm thinking this is going to give me some good ideas on that.
Yeah, it looks like a really good sort of overview of the whole system. One day I'm going to teach myself ACLs, though.
What is it?
ACLs, I think of access control lists. It's more refined controls over what users can see and not see on various drive shares and whatnot. It's you don't usually run into it too much in the general use case, the user group world sort of arrangement that we have by default tends to cover most situations, but when you're dealing with large file shares with a bunch of different users or especially stuff like NFS and whatnot, having specific access control lists for particular files where you can say this, this file belongs to a very particular list of users that there's not a clean group overlap for them, or you have a file owned by a group but you have say six different users that aren't necessarily in that group but they still need access to that file. You get a little bit more versatility with ACLs, but the controls are way different than your standard sort of chmod and whatnot.
Cool. Sounds like a great topic for HPR. And since I haven't done anything in years for HPR, I am ashamed.
Yeah, if we can just find somebody who knows how to actually do it without looking it up, that'd be great.
Yeah, I always find the frustrating thing with users and groups is I'm pretty much the only user on everything anyways for the most part. I mean, on the offshoot that my wife needs to access something, so I basically just want pretty much open permissions on everything just so it's less of a pain.
Yeah, that's generally preferable. But a lot of times you install an application and it generates its own user And then you have to figure out why things aren't working and what permissions it actually needs.
Right. What I'm saying is when they start doing things like that, that it gets very frustrating because I'm in a situation where I'm not doing a whole lot of users and groups because it's pretty much just me.
Yeah, I'm there with you.
It's like it was very difficult to find the proper setup for my Samba share that was just complete open permissions. That it didn't require any sort of login, just completely open over the network.
Which is one of the reasons that I prefer SSHFS.
And that makes sense. And even just regular NFS, I should probably try. But Samba seemed to work well with, like my wife still uses Windows systems, so it works well that she can still access the stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've run into fun situations with NFS where unless you do user mappings correctly, you end up, if you don't have a homogenized sort of user list where your UID is different on four or five different computers that, or even two computers, and they're different from the actual connection that you're trying to get to on the NFS share, you can run into issues where unless you remap the UIDs right, NFS can get confused by that. And that's never been a fun thing to try and track down the source of the problem and then, you know, get the right sort of FSTAB stanza to mount everything properly.
Does NFS mount an FSTAB?
I think you can for auto mounting.
Okay. I've never actually tried an NFS.
By the way, while we're talking about getting shares and whatnot, you think the Pi 4 is a nice server machine, even if you have to start with the 1 gig size?
Well, no, not the 1 gig. I definitely wouldn't start with the 1 gig. I mean, people have been using the threes and the twos as servers. So if you're going to go with the 1 gig and you're not planning on doing anything that's CPU intensive, then just go with the 3. I think they dropped the price when the 4 came out. So get the 3B+ and use that as a server. Otherwise, wait until you can get a 4.
Well, it depends on what you want to do server-wise, too.
Yeah, it depends on what you're serving.
I've had one of the original, was a Raspberry Pi B, the original B, not even the B plus, as my was it run MediaTomb and Samba. That's it. I got some drives attached to it, and it's been my my network storage for God knows how long now.
Yeah, so you can do it with the older models, the ones, the twos, and the three. So if you can pick one of those up used and that's all you need, then just go with that. I really don't see the point in getting the 1 gigabyte 4 model.
Gotcha. I think if people are picking up the 1 gigabyte model, it's mostly because they want the other things that it offers, like the
separated Ethernet, the USB 3.0.
Yeah, all that stuff.
And I know it is a fairly big price difference, but I agree. I'm kind of the guy. If I get anything less than the maximum, I'm going to regret it.
Well, I'm thinking of actually doing scattershot with working with some threes.
Oh,
working with 3B+. Working with the 4, and because I need, I like the USB 3 capability and the full gig for the server transfer.
Also, remember, we were talking about it a little while ago with the Pi 4. A lot of the software functionality is not there yet. It will be in 6 months to a year, but it's not there today.
That said, I did see a fun little article recently. This is a total digression, but someone got Blender running on a I believe it was a Pi Zero.
Did they get it running well?
for various quantities of well.
Yeah, I've no doubt it would run.
Well, I think the term is walk.
Crawl.
Ooze. So what did they do with it?
It was mostly a can you. And they actually connected a little 1.5-inch screen to it. I'm going to see if I can find the article for it and toss it up in the chat.
Now, has anybody else tried to get Blender? Now, do they have an ARM version for Blender? That seems kind of useless, doesn't it?
Yes, a little bit. But that is the beauty of open source. That whole thing of just be can doesn't mean you should. Nobody tends to pay attention to that.
Fair.
Well, the cool thing about Blender is that you can run it in a. That was one of the things Klaatu always talked about when he went from Mac to open source. You know, it is that the machines he had back then, he could cluster them all and run and then run Blender. So it depends on how many processors you can throw at the project.
Also, there is a cluster hat for the Pi that uses a standard Pi 2 or 3, whatever, as a host, and then you have a whole bunch of Pi zeros.
And I would question, what would be faster for 4 Pi zeros or a single Pi 3?
Well, with your clustered Pis, there's always some overhead because there has to be a controller device. But then don't you also have to have specialized software made to run that way?
Well, that's always the point. I mean, if your software is single-threaded, there's no point.
The interesting thing with the Pi 4, there are people already doing Docker and Kubernetes and stuff like that on it.
Oh, sure. I ran Docker on a Pi 2, and I'm running it. The Etherpad is running in a Docker container on a Banana Pi. That thing's not fantastic, trust me.
But once again, you have to have the ARM versions that will run Docker, or Docker images that are ARM versions for any of those, right?
Right. And I think they have to be the right version of ARM, too. I'm not sure. Whether it's going to be like the ARM version 5 or by ARM version 7. Do you know, does anybody here know whether something that's compiled for ARM version 5 will run on an ARM version 7 chip?
No clue.
Okay, so I have the Orange Pi R1, and I was thinking about IP Fire and using it that way, but... So I went on the IPFire website, and it's got a ARM download, but in the description, the description of the image, it says ARM version 5, I believe, and the Orange Pi R1 is an ARM version 7, so I'm not sure whether that'll work or not. I guess I could just DD the image, plop it in there, fire it up, and see if it does anything.
Well, it looks like, Honky, you got something else going on with the on MeWe as well that you posted.
Yeah, what this was just an article that somebody wrote that basically they're trying to say that that we've hit a point on Linux where gaming on Linux is almost as good as gaming on Windows. It tried to say that it is as good, but if you look at what they were doing, he had a System 76 laptop that he had to get Windows running on, and then try to use that version of Windows on a System 76 machine to try to run a benchmark versus the Pop OS. And it pretty much was on par with some things, better with some, worse with others. But it was, I think it's a good example of how far we've come with gaming on Linux. I just threw it out there as kind of a pat in the back, to those who are working on it, just to kind of show that they are still working on it and they're doing a good job with it.
Yeah, I'm still behind on gaming, so so I have to read more on that article.
Well, from what I understand, there's still a lot of games that won't play on Linux without quite a bit of tweaking with either Steam software Proton or Lutris or Wine or something to that effect. But a lot of times once things are running and optimized, they get better frame rates in Linux than they would in Windows. At least that's what I've understood in the past.
Oh, that's something I wanted to throw out. Well, they've done it for multiple starships in different universes. It's Messy Desk Gaming or something. But I think we're all fans of the Orville. And they'd put out last year a simulation of walking around inside the Enterprise C, or not C, but the next generation Enterprise.
1701D?
Yes, the D. And they got a cease and desist, of course, from Star Trek.
CBS,
so.
Probably.
Yeah. Yes. CBS and Paramount. It's probably floating around out there as far as they got. But then they started on the Orville, and Seth was like, excellent, man, do this. We aren't going to mess with you. So, and it's still on alpha, but until today, it's been, only to selected people. But today or tomorrow, sometime this weekend, it is supposed to be released to the public. I didn't want to do it till I saw if it, put up a link until I saw if it ran in Linux. Or, I'm sure it's a Windows version, but if it ran in Wine in Linux. So by next show, I will have downloaded it and tested it. But they keep adding things. I don't know if it'll ever be, yes, I'm going to jump into the pilot seat and go fry caissons. But, it's kind of like that because you can jump in and fly around and you can go to the various, bridge stations and do stuff and go to rooms. You can go into the, commander's ready room. You can go into all the, quarters of the main characters. Well, I don't know. You can go to Bordas' quarters. You can go into Seth's quarters. You can go in the sick bay. You can go into the second in command quarters. You can go into the flight deck and slip and fall in the P corner. And, you can go in the mess deck, various other things, and you can, spawn the ship in different places. And like I said, you can fly the ship. I don't know if it'll ever be like you can go in combat with the ship, though that would be incredibly cool. And it's like first person. You can go in first person. You can go in third person. If you go in third person, you can go outside the ship and then zoom into you sitting on the bridge in the pilot chair and various other things. Eventually, you will be able to go into the holodeck, Okay, that's Trek term. Whatever is the Orville equivalent, and be able to run all of the simulations that have that have appeared in the show, including Bortus Island, which I will not mention anymore.
Why?
Because it is mega nasty.
That was one of the funniest parts of that show, was that Bortus's porn addiction in the simulation. Speaking of Linux and gaming, I bought a new gadget, a little handheld Linux-based retro console called Pocket Go, made by BitBoy.
Yeah, BitBoy actually makes a few different devices, and most of them look really cool.
Yeah, this is the newest one, the Pocket Go. It looks like a Game Boy Advance, like the original one, not the flip-open one. And so far, I've been really happy with it.
Yeah, I put something else in the show notes for you to check out, just because it's similar, and it's what I'm thinking about getting to put together with my son, because I know that he would just get a kick out of it. And it's the, where is it? I got the Amazon link here. The Game Hat for the Raspberry Pi. And it comes with a 3.5-inch screen, and you can load either your own RetroPie along with all the drivers onto it, or you can load their image onto it, and that should just work. And then load your own games onto it, of course. And it just looks like something that my son would just love to put together.
Yeah, I can see something like that being a really fun project for your son. And put it together, and then you get to see the results of your work when you play it.
Yeah. And I have 18650 batteries just sitting around, so.
Yeah, this little console, it's it was under $40, and it can play everything up to PS1, a few PS1 games, mainly the 2D ones, but it's mainly made for NES, SNES, and it's got Neo Geo. All the emulators are already on there. Surprisingly, I guess because it's from China, there was a lot of games that were on there already too, NES and SNES and things like that.
It's already got the pre-working BIOSes on it, because that's the important part right there.
Yeah, yeah, everything's already loaded. All you have to do is put your games on the SD card. It runs from the SD card too. There's no
internal storage.
Internal storage, yeah, but well, For what it costs, I've been pretty happy with it so far.
Neo Geo probably has some of the better games on it, just for quality, and other than, you know, the PlayStation 1 games, but I'll get to that in a second. But yeah, between Neo Geo and the MAME, most of the time with most of the like RetroPie systems I set up, or any other RetroArch system that I set up, it just ends up being easier to get the MAMEs working than it is to get Neo Geo working.
Yeah, I was surprised how well Neo Geo worked. I've got both MAME set and a bunch of Neo Geo games on there. Both emulators work really well. And it also came with some PC games like Doom and Quake and games like that. Hexen, I think, was another one. But mostly I've been playing SNES and Boy Advance on there, and I haven't had any issues.
Well, two games I'm going to recommend out of the classics pile here. One of them is for Sega Genesis, and that's the original version of Shadowrun.
Yep, I got that.
I love that game. And then the other one I'm going to recommend is the, see if you can get the PlayStation 1 version of Armored Core Masters of Arena to play.
I've never played any of the Armored Core games. They've always looked pretty cool, though. I didn't really even know about them until they started coming out on the PS2, but it's always been something I wanted to check out.
Well, I played some of the other Armored Core games, and really Masters of Arena is the only one I enjoyed.
It's got Sega Master System. These are the emulators that are already on it. It comes with
Masters is Genesis.
Yeah. Well, no, the Sega Master System, the first Sega system before the Mega Drive.
It's Mega Drive that's Genesis.
Yeah, okay, it's got that as well. And it's got SNES, it's got Game Boy Color, the original Game Boy, Game Boy Advance, PS1, MAME, Neo Geo. Oh, it also has the PC Engine, the TurboGrafx-16 on there.
Right, yeah. It sounds a lot like a well-built version of RetroArch.
Yeah, that's basically what it is. And it's the form factor is great, and it's a rechargeable, internal rechargeable battery. I don't know if you can replace the battery or not. They send you four buttons, rainbow buttons, if you want to replace the standard red and gray buttons. So I had it open.
You know, with a screwdriver and enough courage, any battery is replaceable.
Yeah, that's true. I'm wondering if the battery that's in there is anything special, you know, to the console itself, or if any similar size battery would work.
Well, as long as the output's the same, you'll be fine.
Let's see. I got it right here in front of me. Atari 2600, Lynx, DOS games, WonderSwan, and then several Game Boy emulators. Then it's got your standard, like your file browser and things like that. And
does it have a version of Kodi built into it?
No. It's actually not that powerful where I think it would run Kodi well enough to be usable.
Okay.
But as far as like some of the older games, it does fine. It does have a media player. It comes with M-Player, but I haven't tried that because I haven't put any videos on there.
Okay. Does it have a USB port?
It has a mini USB or micro USB port.
OTG? As far as,
I don't know. I don't think so. I think that's only for charging. I haven't tried to actually access the SD card through the USB port, but I don't think it will. I think it's only for the battery, to charge the battery.
Well, with, you know, M Player on there and things like that, I'm wondering if you can connect it to the internet with like USB Ethernet and do an apt-get update.
I don't think so. I don't think that the USB port on there has access to any of the hardware except for the battery.
Okay.
And I was trying to figure out exactly what it's running, like what they're calling this operating system.
Well, that would be another thing, you know, getting a keyboard hooked up to it.
Yeah, I still haven't really figured it out. It's a custom it's a custom OS, and it's not just built for this. I mean, it was built, I think it came from the, do you remember the, well, maybe they're still around, Ding-X or something like that? It was another emulation console, but it's a port of that, but I've never used that before.
I don't know. The only other one other than RetroArch that I've been using is Batacera, which it just looks exactly like RetroArch and has, you know, Kodi along with it.
Yeah, this one is open source. It's under GPL, but I still can't figure out what it's called. But you can see, you know, it when it boots, you can see it run through all the processes. And it's got an all-winter CPU on it. It has 32 megabytes of ROM, which isn't much. So any game that's bigger than that takes a while to load. I noticed on the – I haven't played any PS1 games, but I noticed the Neo Geo games, some of them are bigger than that. Like, yeah, 64 megabytes one of them was, and it took forever to load.
Hmm.
Anyway, I recommend it. It's got an actual – glass screen on it, which I was kind of surprised with, and the battery lasts quite a while too. But it's similar to the BitBoy, the retro handheld, except it has shoulder buttons and the form factor is a little bit different.
Right, because he had that one that looked exactly like one of the original Game Boys.
Yeah, those original BitBoys were basically the same Game Boy shell.
Yeah, but did you have to put those together yourself? I don't remember the kit. I remember looking at the final product and that's it.
Well, they had shells for the Pi Zero, I know.
Right, okay, that's what it was.
But they also sold the kit, you know, everything completely put together.
Cool. Well, we just finished feedback. You want to guys get into the show topic part of this? Which I guess 50's up first on his stuff.
Yeah, me. All I have is, you know, links and stuff that, and I think Minix has, you know, got some actual content. The only thing I want to say is from last show, I did get finally Electron Player installed and connected it to my Netflix and Hulu subscriptions, and you know, worked perfectly. And YouTube worked great, that you know, without subscription. So this, you know, a year ago when I was playing around and saying, let's see if we can get Android apps running under Linux, those were a couple things that I had in mind, and Electron Player satisfies that itch. If anybody wants to watch Netflix and YouTube, or Netflix and Hulu, and YouTube, in a interface other than the browser.
Right. Don't get me wrong, it's something cool. I'm just wondering what the benefit is over, say, the browser.
Well, a lot of people want, you know, for privacy or whatever, want to get away from the browser.
Okay. Well, I know that there's also a couple of browsers that don't necessarily work with Netflix or Silverlight. So I guess that could be helpful there.
I mean, there, you know, there's a movement out there to de-Google.
Right. And for the longest time, I know, I don't think it's an issue anymore. I know that for the longest time, Firefox, you just couldn't freaking get Netflix to work on it without jumping through a crap ton of hoops.
Right. Right. I don't think that's, and you know, for me, I don't want, you know, I know people who watch their content through a computer screen. It's like, no, I want to throw it over to my Chromecast and throw it up on the TV.
Well, that if you're going to set up some sort of a set-top box, it's a lot easier to have one application to be bouncing around, and as opposed to having to set up a browser.
Has anybody had any luck getting Netflix and or Amazon Prime Video working on Kodi? I installed them and they just ran terribly.
I'm not surprised about Amazon Prime not working on Kodi, but I am kind of surprised about Netflix not working on Kodi. I mean, I haven't done a Kodi setup in forever, so.
Yeah, they work, as in they will play, but it's very stuttering, and the image quality is, for some reason, it just doesn't come through as HD.
With what kind of hardware?
This was on a last time I tried it, it was on an ARM. What was it? RK3328 and four gigs of RAM, something like that. A little small little set top box, running LibreElec.
Maybe it was a hardware limitation.
Yeah, it definitely could be.
And the fourth service in that was Floatplane. And just like Joe talked about, you know, you pretty much have to go. It's like a YouTube. It's a YouTube-like service, but to get content, you have to subscribe to each and every channel.
Hey, Minix. Jay Rulo is asking what app on Kodi that you were using to watch Amazon videos.
I forgot what it was called. I had to install it from a GitHub repository. Hang on a second. I'll look and see if I can find it. Okay, I'm going to post it in the Mumble. It looks like it's still being developed, too. The last update was 17. The last commit was 17 days ago, so I might want to give it a try. It's been a while since I tried it. It may be better now. I don't know.
All right, Minix, did you want to go through some of your topics?
Yeah, sure. I was just going to mention a few projects that I'd been working on since I was last time I was on the show. One is I have some land in East Texas, and we're having a real bad problem with these feral hogs that are just everywhere now. And I looked online what would be the best trap. And it looks like the one that most people are using are these monitored traps, where you have the basic corral trap and the gate, like a guillotine style gate, and it has a camera that it monitors the hogs with and sends you a picture to your cell phone, and that way you can see what's in the gate. And if it's something you want to catch, it has a relay attached to the gate itself that you just call that relay. It's a cellular relay, and it sets the trap. And online, they were selling a completed one that was, I think, just for the camera, it was over $600. And just for the gate with the relay was something crazy, like $1,200. So I saw how they made it, so I figured I could probably do it myself. And so I found the camera, which is a cellular remote-controlled camera on AliExpress, and that was $120. And you just put a SIM card in there, and it detects motion, and it'll send a picture, text message you a picture. And then I found I didn't know they had these relays that you can put a SIM card in too, that just send a signal to whatever you got it connected to. I think people are using them mainly for like garage doors or, apartment entrances and things like that. And that was about $30, and I found that. And then I got a linear actuator, which is like an electronic piston that the one I got came off a tanning bed, I believe, but you send a current to it and it extends, and then if you reverse the polarity on that current, it retracts. So that's how it works. It usually has a switch that will reverse that current, and that linear actuator I can use to set the gate. I made a YouTube video of how I put it all together and stuff. I put that in the show notes, but with the relay and the camera and then the linear actuator, and then I needed a battery to run it all, it was, under $200. So I saved quite a bit of money, and it's worked so far. We've caught quite a few hogs with it. But if you watch that video, you kind of get a clearer picture of how it works, and it's all just cellular controlled, and it's been doing a good job so far.
Now, Minix, I know I've asked you this question online, but just to clarify, like up here, we don't have the feral hogs, but we do have the wild turkeys. And people may catch them in a similar manner, and they'll talk about, oh yeah, it's great, man, it's delicious, and of course they're all doing it in these fryers that set people's houses on fire. But and I think a lot of these, a lot, a lot, I haven't had the wild turkey, and a lot of these people probably, by comparison to domestically raised turkey that get in Walmart or whatever, it's probably a little more tough or whatever, but these feral hogs that you do catch, do you consume them, or is it like catch and release?
Well, with hogs, it's a little bit different. There's several things you can do. One is there's these hunting ranches that will buy live hogs from you by the pound. And what they do is they just let them loose on these ranches, and then people pay to come and hunt hogs. So if you have a livestock trailer, you can take them to one of those places. As far as eating them, the thing about these feral hogs, because they're not castrated like you would a hog that on a factory farm or whatever, once they hit puberty, the meat takes on a totally different taste with whatever hormones or whatever's going through their muscles and their body, and it's not good. You basically have to, like you said, cook the crap out of it, like they do with the wild turkeys, or smoke it for a long, long time to get rid of that flavor. So the ones that you eat would be the young males before they go into puberty, or the sows. The sows are fine too. And so you can eat them if you want to. The ones we've caught have been older males, and there's not really much you can do with those. But there's no limit on, you can hunt them at night, you can catch them during the day, you can use traps, you can use nets. They used to have a bounty on them here in East Texas just because they were so bad, but they're starting to get them under control now. They're still pretty bad though. They tear up a lot of land, they're totally invasive. They're not native, so they're actually domestic pigs that have escaped and have just kind of slowly adapted to living in the wild. So they're not like a Russian boar or anything like that. They are mean though. They got tusks. The males do.
Yeah, I've heard of people actually being killed by wild boars.
Yeah, I remember when I was a kid, I was hunting, just deer hunting, and I got chased up a tree by a boar, and I had dropped my rifle. I was probably about 16 or so, and I was just stuck up there until it lost interest and ran away, but there was nothing I could do. So anyway, that's just, I wanted to throw that in because I just wanted to show that if you just kind of did some research and looked up the parts that people are actually putting in these pre-configured traps and things like that, you can save yourself a lot of money. With any, that goes with anything. If you can do it yourself, usually you save a lot of money, and more often than not, you have better control over it. So I just wanted to throw that in there because of that.
Yeah, I have friends with, like the whole chicken truck thing that they've got offline.
I'm not familiar with that. What is the chicken truck?
Okay, it's like a more efficient way to feed your chickens, So, you do have sensors, to open the door, let the chickens out or whatever. But it, you like have this area of grass, and then you move it a little every day. So they come back in,
we call them tractors here, chicken tractors. But it's the same principle. Is it so they can just kind of feed on bugs and stuff in one area, and then you move them to the next area?
Right, and actually, I have a neighbor who does a similar thing with cattle. you know, rather than putting them out on the whole range as everything separated out, and he'll put them on one section for a few weeks and then move them.
Yeah, I saw they were using those chicken tractors. This guy on YouTube was using them, and he didn't have any chickens, but he had a big orchard, an apple orchard, and his neighbor had chickens. And so he would borrow the chickens, put them in these tractors, and move them through the orchards to eat the bugs and to fertilize the ground. And then in the meantime, his neighbor had his chickens fed by eating all the bugs that they were putting in the tractor. So it kind of worked out.
Yeah, there are a lot of symbiotic relationships. Have you ever followed, down there where you are, Tracy Holt. And, he will have this thing with the Tapalaya, and, you know, they will eat the stuff from the bottom, and one of you guys could probably explain it better than I do.
Yeah, I used to follow him. He was into the whole aquaculture business, and he was selling the supplies and stuff to do that too. It was really interesting.
Yeah, you know, he had the Tapalaya and the whole aquaculture and symbiotic stuff, and you know, the critters on top in the symbiotic relationship.
Yeah, I think he was running that water, if I'm not mistaken, from the tilapia tanks through a hydroponic strawberry and blueberry setups to feed them. And it seemed like it was working out really well. I don't think he does that anymore. He moved to Florida, I believe. Now he's driving trucks.
Yeah, I don't know where he moved to, but he is driving trucks right now.
All right, I guess I'll move on to the next one. I've had Zone Minder for years set up on just an old Intel PC, and it worked pretty well. And I had recently moved my Nextcloud server off of my Rock Pro 64 to a new computer I had gotten. And so I had the Rock Pro 64 just open for something and for whatever I wanted. And Zone Minder, I tried it on there, and I don't know if you guys have used it or not, but it's pretty resource intensive, and that little Rock Pro just couldn't handle it. So I came across another open source surveillance system called Shinobi CCTV. Have any of you guys heard of that?
Nope.
No, but Zone Minder is what I talked about earlier. I was going to put my IP cams on. That was exactly what I was going to use, so I'm very interested.
Yeah, I'll put a link in the show notes. It's way lighter than Zone Minder, and I like Zone Minder, but it's also it's very picky about how it's configured, and it's, even though it's still updated, it's kind of, compared to like proprietary security software systems, it's pretty behind as far as features and things like that go. And the interface is kind of archaic. And anyway, I wanted to try something else, and I kind of narrowed it down to a few, and I found this Shinobi CCTV that's all built in Node.js, actually. And it runs really, really well. I've got 4 1080p cameras on the Rock Pro 64. And when I'm using motion detection and recording on all 4 cameras, I'm probably using about 50%. I'm under half load, and there's no way I could have done that with Zone Minder. So it's way lighter, and the RAM usage is way less, and the interface is very sleek. It's very modern. It's easy to use. Configuration can be a little confusing. I've talked to the developer, And he admits that he doesn't have all his documentation updated, but they have a Discord. Any questions you got, you can jump on Discord. And he got back to me really quick. I had a few questions. But running on that little ARM single board computer, I was surprised how well it does. And so far, it's been, you know, rock solid. I'm running the Rock Pro 64 or the Pine port of Ubuntu server on there, and then it's just running headless with Shinobi CCTV. That's the only thing that's on there. But yeah, give it a try if you're looking, especially for a single board computer. I've seen a lot of posts of people using a Shinobi on Raspberry Pis and things like that, and still, you know, being able to access all the features that you would on a LAMP stack with ZoneMinder or something like that. So I've been happy with it for what it can do with limited hardware. It's pretty impressive.
Well, thanks. That's kind of exactly what I would be looking for.
Yeah, and it the motion detection is not exactly there yet as far as like dialed in when you first set it up. So it takes a while to set like what they call like differential, which is what percentage of an image is changed compared to before, to set off the motion detection, and pixel analysis, which, you know, is like how different a color is compared to how it was before. That's how the motion detection works. So you have to do a little bit of configuration and just kind of testing and trial and error until you get something that works for you. But it's very, as far as setting that up, it's all done through the web interface, and the menus are nice and clean, and the documentation is built into the web interface too. So each option will say what the option does, and after you kind of get used to it, it's good.
Now, is there any tie-in for magnetometers yet?
No, not that I know of, but they do have a plug-in system. I mean, like they have the license plate plug-in. Like, you know, like what Rich was looking for. It's not built into it, but they have a plugin available that you can add to it if you want to identify license plates. But I've used ZoneMinder for a long, long time and just kind of got used to it over the years. So I'm, you know, it's pretty big RAM hog, especially with newer cameras that are 1080p and stuff like that. Oh, and the cameras I'm using are called Wyze, W-Y-Z-E. You may have heard of them. They're kind of becoming popular right now, and they come with motion detection, all that stuff is built into the software on those cameras, but I turn all that off because I'm using it through Shinobi. And but if you wanted to just use the camera, you can't without an NVR. You can, because it has a phone app and all that stuff, but I'm not comfortable with my surveillance footage going to, they send it to an Amazon web service that stores it for you, and it's free. But yeah, I didn't want to do that either. So all the cameras that I have, I blacklisted them on my network so they can't get to the internet. And when I first did that, I was watching my packets, and they were still calling servers and reaching them, and I couldn't figure out why. And I read up on them, and they actually use a technology called, I think it's called ThruTech, but it's a NAT punching tech that they use on these cameras. So it just automatically punches a hole through your NAT from inside your network to get what they need to do, so that you don't have to set up any port forwarding or whatever. And so I had to block basically every single port, 1 through 65, 535 or whatever, on each camera within my network, just so that they wouldn't call home. And I got that to work through the, I think it's called network filtering services on my router. And so that they don't, the only thing that I can reach is the actual Shinobi server, and I reach that through a VPN. But I've also set up SMTP on the Shinobi server, so it if it detects motion, it'll send me a email with a 10-second video and then a screenshot automatically to my Gmail address. So that's the only access it has on to the internet is to send me an email. But those Wyze cameras are really nice. I think they're $20 or $25, and they work great. They've got infrared and night vision and all that stuff too. Yeah, I've been seeing them at like Home Depot and places like that. And Wyze has a special firmware you can put on them that enables RTSP for the transport protocol, so that you can use it with an NVR. And oh, I know what I wanted to talk about. I had a question to ask you guys. So, and I don't think it's specific to Shinobi CCTV, but I have a Shinobi has a scheduler, so that you can do motion detection and recording. You know, you can schedule that. You know, say when you're away from work and when you come home. But what I'd rather do is have it schedule recording whenever my phone is not on my wireless network, and then to turn off recording when it's on my wireless network. So that's, I think that would be a lot easier instead of, because I may come home early, or on the weekends it's difficult to schedule when I'm going to be there and not be there. But if there is some way that you guys know of that I could do a, like a network recognition of when my phone is connected and when it's not, there's some app or something.
I don't know about an app, and there probably is an app, but the thing that's coming to my mind is SSHing into your router and dumping information from the computer where your CCTV software is running. And it's going to have to pull like every minute or every 5 minutes. And then, you know, actions based on whether or not your phone is one of the devices connected to your Wi-Fi.
Like it would, if it recognizes the MAC address of the phone.
Right.
Then it would enable or disable. Well, the thing about that is that the Shinobi server is, oh, okay, I know what it could do. So if it reads my MAC address, the Shinobi server could, or not the Shinobi server, but the router could cut off a network connection to the cameras, so the Shinobi server wouldn't have any information to process, so it couldn't do motion, you know, detection or recording. Then I think it would work something like that. What do you think?
Run that by me one more time.
I was thinking about what you were saying about doing it via like it recognizes my MAC address on my phone connected to the network. And if you could write a rule that the router would cut off network services to the Wi-Fi cameras.
Ah, okay. Yeah. Yeah. Then, do it all on the router side. Yeah.
Yeah. Then since there's no input going to the Shinobi server, there's nothing to trigger it or do any recording or motion detection in the first place.
Another way you could do it from the computer where the software is running is on your router, you give your cell phone a static IP, and then from there you should be able to ping that local IP address, right? And if you get a response, then it's on the network. If you don't, it's not. I don't know if that would work, though, while your phone is idle.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. I don't know. I know there's a way to do it. Are you guys familiar with Home Assistant, which is the open source home automation?
I've heard of it, but I haven't used it.
I was going to say Home Assistant or Node-RED.
Yeah, I think there's a way to do it with that. But
if
I don't know how much resources it takes up as far as if I put it on the Shinobi server.
There should be a way to do it with IFT as well.
Yeah,
IFT can detect if you're home or not.
Yeah, but IFT has to go off the network, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. Right now, I've got everything just contained within my network, so I kind of want to keep it that way.
Okay.
I would say check out probably Node-RED. I did notice an home automation assistant that they do have stuff, plugins for, like, ASUS routers, but I'm not sure. But they might have some plugins for some other ones, too, but definitely take a look at both of those, home automation assistant and Node-RED.
Yeah, and I've never installed or messed with home automation software at all. So it's always been an area I wanted to get into, and so I guess this would be a good starting point.
I guess speaking of routers, and ASUS routers in particular, I have an ASUS router, and I installed a custom firmware called Merlin on it. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that.
Mm-mm.
I've never played with it, but I have heard of it.
Yeah, it's pretty cool, and it may be based off the old WRT software, but it looks just like the ASUS stock factory software, except it has different extra options and a little more fine tuning you can do. But one of the cool options is to install, you know, like plugins and scripts from a huge repository that they have that's made for this Merlin custom firmware. And I've messed around with like a pie hole before as far as ad blocking within my network. And they have a plugin called Diversion, and I linked to it in the show notes. And it's a script that runs on the natively on the ASUS Merlin firmware. And it works really good. It does basically the same thing Pi-hole does. And I linked to it in the show notes. Diversion is what it's called. And it installs on the ASUS router itself. And check it out. If you have an ASUS router, definitely check out the Merlin firmware, because it opens up a lot of possibilities. To get the Diversion working, you just have to plug in a flash drive into the router itself. But so far, it's been great, and you know the ASUS firmware has its own open VPN server on there, and so what I'll do a lot of times is just log into my home VPN and browse from there, and then I'm ad free whatever I'm looking at, you know, on the internet.
Nice.
Let's see, what else did I have? Oh, this is not really Linux related or anything, but I don't know if you guys have this problem. I have a really bad habit of not throwing away like old PCs that are out of date and stuff like that. And so I've got these giant cases everywhere. And at the workshop where I teach classes at here at the Dallas Makerspace, we have milling machines. And I found some cheap acrylic. And what I did, I'll have to throw some pictures up. I need to take some pictures of this. What I did is basically just took the motherboards and the power supply out of those cases. And once you do that, it's pretty small then, and then the power switch and stuff. And I made a kind of like an acrylic case, but it's not really a case. It's mainly just a platform to put the square acrylic platform to mount the motherboard to. And then Oh, go ahead.
Speaking of the Dallas Makerspace, are you going to be there tomorrow?
No, I won't be there tomorrow. This is my mom's birthday weekend, so unfortunately I'll be out of town. Are y'all having the
lugs tomorrow?
Lug there tomorrow? Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, I still need to make it out there. I need to get Ed to come with me, too, and come and check it out. But is it one time a month? Is that when you guys do it?
Yeah, just once a month, every third Saturday. So usually, barring like rare occasions, it's right after the second meeting of this show for the month.
Yeah, dang it. I keep forgetting about it. I want to go up there and check it out. I haven't been to the lug up there. Is it the North Texas something?
Yeah, the NT lug.
Yeah, that's it. But what I was kind of doing with the acrylic was I just made a square panel And I bought these cheap standoffs from AliExpress. And so I have two square panels. The bottom panel is just big enough to house the motherboard. And then the top panel, I mount the power supply on it and the hard drive. And so I've reduced the size from a big PC tower to a motherboard on the bottom, and then the power supply and the hard drive on the top. And then right now I haven't mounted the power switch to anything sturdy, but that I'll have to figure out a good way to do that. Maybe use some more acrylic and some epoxy or something. But so I threw away these old cases I had and just kept the MOBO and the power supply and the hard drives.
Like a test bench setup?
Yeah, kind of like that. And it, you have the downside of dust getting in there, but these are computers that I'm... Yeah, can you hear me?
Is my mic on?
I hear you. Did I go off?
Did I lose my connection?
No, I hear both of you.
Yep.
I hear you, Joe. I don't think Joe can hear us. But it's kind of like Joe was saying. It's like when they do the workbench setup just to test the motherboard. It's kind of like that, but it makes it a lot smaller. And I have space to put these computers, and they're just going to be running headless anyway for some server application. And these standoffs, I got like 50 different kinds of standoffs for like $3 from AliExpress, and they're all brass. And I put some rubber feet on the bottom of the bottom acrylic panel, and it worked out pretty well. So if you can find some cheap acrylic and or whatever plastic I guess you wanted to use, it worked for me. I'll take some pictures and I'll post them.
Actually, I've been looking.
Yeah, I love those setups.
I've been looking at some of the Pi 3 cases that are built that way. A Pi 4 will go right in if it's just the top and bottom.
Sorry about that. My laptop seems to have lost its connection currently, so I'm on my phone for a few minutes.
Yeah, Jay Rulo just posted in the chat some acrylic he got, and yeah, they work great for motherboards. And it doesn't have to be thick. And what he showed, I think, is... did you say you got it free, Jay? Oh, yeah. He said he found it behind a building.
Can't do any better than that.
My favorite way to get things. Free.
So, anyway, I just thought I'd mention that if you wanted to save some space and you've got some old PCs lying around.
So, is that like a test bench setup?
It's similar to what they would do with the test bench setup, yeah. Okay. The only difference is that it's not really meant to be taken apart after you put it together. It's just a way to conserve space and still hang on to the actual relevant hardware out of there.
Okay, so did you mount the power supply to the same piece of acrylic?
No. So it's like a two-stack. So the bottom piece of acrylic, all it holds is the motherboard, and I have a little place reserved there where I'm going to put the power switch because it's just kind of dangling right now.
Right.
And then I have four standoffs that elevate a second piece of acrylic above the motherboard, and on that piece is the power supply and the hard drives. Yep. I didn't want to put it below it because the heat from the power supply, I notice, rises up, and I didn't want it to heat up the motherboard and add more heat that way. Because it's open air, but still, there's no forced cooling. There's no fans or anything going.
That's still pretty cool. I don't have any acrylic, but I know I got some old old computer cases sitting around, and it would be possible to, you know, just take off the sides and use that.
Yeah, definitely. Anything stable like that would work, and you could just those standoffs. I mean, you don't have to get them from AliExpress; you can get them anywhere, but you can find them real cheap from China. I looked at standoffs at Micro Center, and they were expensive.
Yeah, well, as soon as you said Micro Center,
But I've seen them on eBay too, as well. Really cheap. And they're nice. You can get the stainless ones or the brass ones, and like 2, 3, 4 inch standoffs, whatever size you need.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask next. On the length that you picked for those.
Yeah. So the one for, I have an Intel and 2 Athlon computers, and the Intel one, the fan on top of the CPU was a little taller than the Athlon one, and so I chose the three inch standoffs for that one, and the 2 Athlon ones I got by with I think it's 2.5 inch standoffs for those, but and then I just put these stick on rubber feet, like the clear, they're not rubber, I guess it's whatever that clear silicone type of bumper feet are on the bottom. And that just keeps it off the floor or off the shelf. I have no idea what I'm going to use them for, but I'm sure I'll find a use someday.
There actually was a Pi-driven website, which was known as Server on the Wall.
Well, he may have like that.
He may have had several different iterations, but yes, there was Server on the Wall. That was his site.
All right, yeah, guys. I didn't even think about that. You could. I don't think there would be an issue with mounting them vertically like that.
It's getting a little late. I'm getting tired.
Yep. Are we? There was one more question on there, but if we open that one up, I think we're going to be here for a while. So maybe I want to table the licensing conversation until another one.
Yeah, we can save that for next time. I think that's a pretty big topic, but I just want to mention there's a Hacker Public Radio episode maybe a month or so ago about a new permissive license called Blue Oak, and that's what got me thinking about that question. I recommend everybody listen to it if you get a chance. Just search Blue Oak on Hacker Public Radio. It's an interesting talk, but yeah, we can get into that topic next time.
Yeah, I'll look for that. Thanks.
All right, so our next recording date will be August 2nd, 2019. Our music is Downright, provided by Klaatu and Brome. We'd like to thank Delwyn for use of the Mumble server. We'd also like to thank 000 Web Host for web hosting. And finally, we'd like to give special thanks to Father Finch and Tony Bemis for their help and support over the years. Have a good one.
Awesome. You got that link that you were asking me for? I can't find it.
Yeah, I looked at my browser history from the last time I was on, and I found it. I just added some show notes on there.
Can you send me the link real quick, or am I going through my browser history too?
Yeah, I'll send it. Hold on. Honky beat me to it.
Awesome. Okay. Yeah, I haven't been doing much interesting lately, so I'll just jump in where I can. But hey. Yeah. It's my birthday.
Oh, happy birthday, man.
That's right. Happy Thank birthday.
You. Hey, Honky.
Hey, what's going on?
Just another Friday night.
Well, I'm just trying to stay off the broiler.
You keeping cool?
Sort of. I've been making alternate arrangements to have a place to hole up in my cellar for the next couple of days.
Supposed to be 99 here over the weekend.
Oh, the temperature's come down a little bit then.
They're saying effective temperatures up to 117 in the Boston area.
My mom, she lives out kind of in the boonies in East Texas, and her internet situation was the same as 50s was, where there wasn't really any access to any kind of high-speed internet. Today I installed a 4G hotspot there, and got her set up. It's between 15 and 20 megabits. It's not bad at all. And she was paying, I think, $60 to CenturyLink, and was getting less than 1 megabit for internet. And this has like opened up a whole new world for her.
Nice.
Any caps?
There's no data caps. If you go to eBay and you search AT&T Unlimited, they have these resellers on there that that sell these old grandfathered in contracts that they buy from people. And it's $35 a month for unlimited data, but there's no talk or text. It's data only. I think they were selling these originally for like iPads and stuff. And so you just, you buy the contract from them. I think I paid $20, and you give them the number on your SIM card, and they set up just a kind of like a placeholder account and give you a password. And it's on the actual AT&T website. You go there and then you fill in your correct information, change your password, and you're ready to go.
Damn.
There's another service called NetBuddy. I think it works similar, and it's 4G as well, and it's made for rural areas like that that get kind of left out when it comes to broadband internet. So I'm hoping she'll be happy with this. So far, she said it works great. I mean, she uses all of our streaming accounts, Netflix, Amazon. I think my aunt has HBO, but she's never been able to watch them because she just didn't have the speed.
Hmm.
The most expensive part is the router. You got to buy the hotspot router. And I bought the, I think it's made by Nectar, called Nighthawk AT&T 4G hotspot. And yeah, I got that from
it's the equivalent of an AC 1900.
Yeah, and I got that from eBay too, from a reseller. And it was new and in the box, but it was like $100 less.
Yeah, about $42.
No. This is the one, the Netscape Nighthawk 4G hotspot router.
Okay.
Yeah, it's $250 at Best Buy, and on eBay they had it new in the box for $150, so I bought that.
No, because there are other ways to do it that may or may not be as reliable. Because I know you can get the USB 4G modems, and I know that you can get, if you get a high enough end router, it has basically extra memory, and then you put OpenWRT on there, and then you can install something like either EasyTether or some 4G software and use it that way, but it's probably more difficult than the way you did it.
Where would you put the SIM card, though?
In the USB.
Okay, I see what you're saying. So this USB is just to hold the SIM card, then?
Well, yeah, it's a USB modem that you connect to the router, but you have to have special firmware on the router to make it work correctly.
Yeah, this is a router and a modem in one, an LTE modem combined. The Wi-Fi is actually pretty good. It doesn't have any external antennas on it. I was surprised how far it reaches, you know, all through the house. And she's getting great speeds for $35 a month, a lot better than what she was paying. And that's the only cell signal you can get out there is AT&T. Verizon, Sprint, and T-Mobile, they don't have signal.
Yeah, my brother does mobile AT&T for mobile phone and internet. Of course, since he goes over the country, he also finds where even AT&T runs out. Evidently, the envelope and groundhogs don't need cell phones yet.
Okay, I found an example of a really simple one that you wouldn't have to do the custom firmware on unless you wanted to. I've used this, well, you have to put the custom firmware on it for EasyTether before, but that means that you're using the USB to your phone. The TP-Link MR3040. But you'd also have to buy the USB 4G LTE modem with it.
Yeah, I'm looking at it now. I see what you're saying, though. Yeah.
Yeah, and I got one right here in my hand.
I figured this would probably be the easiest for her because I don't live there and she doesn't know anything about technology and like me just trying to explain how this works was a challenge in itself that she didn't have to do anything because she doesn't understand the difference between her internet coming from off a cable that she's paying CenturyLink for and then, you know, over 4G LTE service. I try to explain to her that it was just like her phone, you know, it's the same thing. It's just a small hockey puck instead. But she couldn't make the connection. I just gave up.
Right. No, I just mentioned it because you can do some really cool projects with the TP-Link MR3040. Just make sure you keep a copy of the original firmware around because once you put the custom firmware on it, you might lose some functionality that if you want back later, it's easier to switch back with. It's a great little project piece.
Actually, I've been looking at more Wi-Fi stuff. What I'm thinking about is building an access point with VPN built in for Wi-Fi.
Yeah, that's a great way to do it. You'll find that a lot of your routers today come with some kind of VPN client built in, not just the server, but a client where you can connect out and then all of your connections that go through it will be automatically connected to that VPN. Or you can set up your own.
Well, what I'm looking for is to have an access point where the access point is a VPN server.
Yep.
So you log into the server and
you cut out there. Are you trying to set up a home VPN server? Netminer?
They got him.
They got him.
Evening, 50.
Everybody hear me okay?
Yep.
Sound good?
I think we lost Netminer.
Sound good?
I'm here.
Okay. Well, we lost you partway through that conversation, and it was getting good.
Well, I was just, especially with the new pies, I was looking at making it so that my tablet would just go when it did a Wi-Fi connection, it would just go VPN.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I've considered doing this before because there were some less technologically capable people using my internet in the house was having two routers, one that was not VPN'd and then one that was VPN'd. And then you would just switch your Wi-Fi access point dependent on whether or not you wanted a VPN. And the router would be connected to a VPN server.
Well, now, are you doing VPN on the wire or are you doing VPN over air?
That the VPN would be on the wire because it would go from the router to the VPN because the router has VPN client software built in. So the Wi-Fi would connect to the VPN. So I guess there would be a small section of it that was unencrypted.
Yeah, well, what I was thinking is if the access point, I don't know if this is doable over Wi-Fi. Certainly my tablet has a bunch of things for VPNs.
Mm-hmm.
And it only supports Wi-Fi, so it must be possible to do Wi-Fi knocks on the door of your access point and then it goes to a second handshake, which is VPN.
So you want the tablet to have its own VPN access and not the router?
Yeah, I want, well, once you have
the VPN access point, as I understand it, you can anything over Wi-Fi can have its own sort of VPN login to your access point.
Right. If you're setting up a VPN server, then yeah, you can have as many machines connect to it as you want to. But my question then becomes, is your exit point? Because if you're running your server, then you're your own exit point, and there's really no point if you're at home to log into your home VPN. Now, if you have something like PIA, then you have... Excuse me. Tried to hit the mute button there before I sneezed. Now, if you have a service like PIA, then it is possible to have your router connected to PIA and your individual device connected through to PIA, but then that gets kind of pointless too because you're encrypting your encryption, and so individual devices could easily connect to PIA, but then there's really no point to having your router set up that way.
Well, why do you say that there's no point to having a VPN for in-home access?
From home into your home? Because if your VPN is in your home and you're also in your home and you're VPNing or your device is connected to your VPN router, then you're the endpoint. At that endpoint, it gets decrypted to go out over the wire. Basically, the only thing that would be encrypted on that VPN is local network access, because it'll get decrypted before it goes out to the big wide world.
Yes, that's what I'm looking at, is having the option of having secure access to the internal network.
Ah, from outside into your house. Now that's perfectly fine. Now that's a good idea. But not from your house to your house, if you're at home using your tablet. You know what I'm saying?
Well, what I'm saying is I'm looking at it more for just securing the in-house network, so I'm in a town with a lot of Wi-Fi and a lot of possibility of snooping. So I would like to secure my network so that I don't get cracked by just having by somebody just cracking the Wi-Fi and getting onto my home net.
Well, even if you're encrypted, which Wi-Fi, you know, okay, it's password protected, and technically it's protected and nobody should be able to get on it. Having a VPN is not going to change that. It's not going to adjust the security of your Wi-Fi.
Okay. So I just have to... If I do PIA or something like that, then I have it out to the world.
Right. That protects your traffic from your house to the endpoint of PIA.
Yeah. And PIA
is a VPN provider, private internet access.
Yeah, I know, but I'm saying PIA... What by putting it on the router, you have that turns your network into one device as far as PIA is concerned.
That is correct.
So I would have... All right. So I can have my secured network and a guest network that's more open for people to borrow, and then I would have PIA either through the router when I'm home and through open internet elsewhere when I'm using public Wi-Fi.
Okay, run that by me one more time.
All right. My brother, who uses some, who uses TunnelBear, doesn't use PIA. PIA has a 5 device per
right.
per standard account. If I put it on the router here, it means that my network is one device as far as PIA is concerned.
Correct.
Now, with that PIA account, when I'm on public Wi-Fi, I can run the client, the Android client, from my library or whatnot to the world.
Yes.
What
that
I
would
don't...
be a second device.
Right. Yeah, what I don't get is, I can do that, and I'm running pfSense, so I know PIA has a setup for single endpoint pfSense setup. Yeah, I looked into it a little while ago. Just this is the first time that I've opened my network up by Wi-Fi.
Yeah, I'll forward to you a mail that, I'm trying to think, friend of the show, I'll think of him, sent me about 6 months ago when I started pfSense. And we've discussed this, how to add a port to a pfSense router, you know, like a USB. to RJ45 and then isolate that. So that can be a guest login. I was thinking more devices like your whatever that you don't trust on your home network, but that would be the way to set up a guest, because you don't want a guest to be able to get it, you know, see your packets flying by.
Well, when you plug in the USB device, whether it's another Ethernet port or a dongle or what have you, you're creating what they call an option interface, and that can have completely separate rules. If I do guesting on my Wi-Fi, on my pfSense box, I will use one of the spare ports on my unit, and that interface will go straight to the internet. Do not pass go, do not collect $200. And you can have a portal on it if you want. You can have other stuff. But the whole deal is that as I understand it, if you add a real port, not just a switch, or not just an unmanaged switch, you are creating yourself a separate... It's a separate connection with completely separate rules, where pfSense says, that packet came in on port 5. Let's see, what's the rule book for port 5?
Yeah, but you have to, I was talking about configuration. By default, my experience was, and we talked about this, this is a while back, I still need to replace my pfSense router that burned up, but... when I added a USB Ethernet port, by default, it could see my network but not the internet. Just the opposite of what I wanted it to do.
Yes, but because you have that rule set, you can go in there and change the rules around. The default may be one thing,
But you can say, wait a minute, these are the rules. Now, with a device that comes and goes like a USB device, I don't know how you get persistence on that, but that's a separate issue.
Well, I said, I knew you could do that. It's just I banged on it for weeks and couldn't figure out how to get the rules to set up like I want them. So,
also, you don't have to have a separate interface unless you're looking for more throughput.
Well, you need a managed switch if you wanted, you know, something to say, okay, anything coming in on these ports, I don't want it to be able to see my network. But if you had a managed switch, it'd be easy enough to do. But with unmanaged switches, you'd need an extra interface on your router, and then plug an unmanaged switch into that.
Right, but yeah, that's what the kind of logical separation of data that you're looking for may be easier to handle with a basic unmanaged switch. There are some semi-smart switches which basically each port on the switch has its own VPN set up, hardwired in, so that as far as PFSense is concerned, they might as well be separate interfaces, because you just say, yes, you know, when something's tagged for port this, here's the rule.
And the friend I was thinking of who sent me the configuration to get PFSense like I want is Tom Lawrence, of course, from Sunday Morning Linux Review. And you may, Netminer, you probably have a lot better handle on the PFSense rules than I do. I tried banging on it for weeks and could not figure out how to get it set up like I wanted.
Well, I haven't done anything. I've got a four-port NIC, or at least I believe it to be a four-port NIC. Haven't confirmed that on my router, and I'm only using the primary port attached to a tree of dumb switches. But I have looked into VLANs and stuff like that, but I haven't really felt the need to go that way where I have spare interfaces.
Anybody watching any new shows or movies?
Just finished Stranger Things.
Yeah, me too. 3.
Yeah.
And I finally watched, I watched that, and I finally went back and watched the last season of Punisher, just starting on
Jones.
Jessica Jones, yeah.
Yeah, I haven't started it yet.
I haven't either. I was so impressed with the first one that the second season was kind of a letdown.
But hey, I'm all caught up with Swamp Thing.
Oh, you are? Do you like it?
Yeah, it's real good.
Yeah, I wanted to bring that up. I was wrong a couple, was it 3 episodes ago, when I talked about the whole tax thing being the reason. That's come out, and it's like, you know, that the state of, I guess it's South Carolina or whatever, they said, you know, whatever office is there that contributes kickbacks or whatever for having your production in their state, you know, and the figure was being bounced around was $30 million, and it's like, we might give that office came back, so we might give $2 million to a project. $30 million is just about our whole budget for a year. Somebody is completely off. And what I heard, and of course, you know, it's just from various YouTube channels, whatever, you know, it's not DC guys, But above them, WB, who now owns DC, they saw Swamp Thing and thought it was too weird. They thought everything was going to be more like Arrow and Flash. And so they immediately called for to cancel Swamp Thing. And apparently and unfortunately, and I think these, you know, if I was one of these suits, I'd be afraid for my life. But apparently Doom Squad is Doom Patrol is also, well, of course, you know, if they think Swamp Thing's weird,
yeah,
you know, they're looking at Doom Patrol.
Yeah, for them to say Swamp Thing is weird and not even mention Doom Patrol is, that's weird to me, because Swamp Thing is not even half as weird as Doom Patrol.
Right.
Oh yeah, they're talking about Doom Patrol being on the chopping block too. And I mean, I can't imagine with the reaction. I mean, that's
like obviously half their lineup.
Weird is what, you know, weird is what everybody wants. You know, a couple years ago, we thought Guardians of the Galaxy was weird, but no, I mean, you know, look at the popularity of the Umbrella Academy. You know, these guys just need to back off and let the people know what they're doing, do what they do.
Well, look at how much coverage Doom Patrol got compared to Titans. I think Doom Patrol was talked about 3 or 4 times as much as Titans was. Titans was a lot more straightforward, you know.
Right. I think these guys, you know, like I said, and maybe this is completely off too. This may be as off as the other story. Who knows? You know, because going off some YouTuber says, yeah, I'm in the know or whatever, but I've seen it more in one place. So, and we talked about this, you know, earlier, that if WB wants to set up their own streaming service, they don't, you know, they're not going to run competition to themselves out of house. So it could be the whole thing goes, you know, goes bye-bye.
Well, I mean, that's always been my criticism of a lot of the mainstream superhero movies, is they don't really take any risks. You know, it seems like they're mainly made by, you know, people that, what do they call us, focus groups and things like that. And they just kind of take an amalgamation of everybody's opinion and make the safest bet. And for the most part, they're pretty forgettable. But something like Doom Patrol and the others, you know, that kind of sticks with you because it's not so straightforward and they actually take a risk.
Yeah, and it just, I don't know. On Marvel, even, where they seem to be going now, well, of course, they've started a couple things that are just characters. No one in the mainstream, you know, nobody except somebody who's really in the comics would have heard of. And now they're, you know, I hear about an Elementals movie and I'm thinking, really, you know, okay. I mean, it just seems like there's more normal Marvel characters that they've never done that they could do first.
Yeah. Something like Flash and Arrow. I think those are perfect for, like, you know, the CW for regular TV, but streaming, that gives you the chance to actually take those risks because you're focused on a narrow, very narrow audience, and instead of trying to appeal to, you know, the masses or whatever, and it seems like that's streaming is where you want to take the chance, you know, and put out some weird stuff that maybe people haven't seen before. That's just my opinion.
Now, one thing I did see, that subscribers in Q3 of Netflix have actually dropped, and it wasn't mentioned. They mentioned a whole bunch of other things, including the price increase, but I'm actually wondering how much of that is to do with them canceling all the Marvel series.
Well, yeah, you're taking that and the fact of all of the other Disney content on there that they're going to be dropping soon.
And another thing, I was shocked until I actually watched the video. It was released yesterday that Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. has been canceled, but it's canceled after the end of next season, which is what I think everybody was expecting it to happen. You know, they were going to do one more season to tie it up. So they've got next season. So I'm not, you know, it's not that because they'd announced, you know, months ago, yeah, there's going to be two more two more seasons of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. And I thought, you know, oh no, they're going to cut it off now. But no, it's a year from now.
What season are they on?
I think six this year. Next year will be seven. And that's one show I have really, you know, started to enjoy the last two or three seasons. You know, I watched about the first season. It's like, I'm not a really big fan of this. And then I think I went back and watched the, you know, two and three on Netflix, and then got caught up. Yeah, this is getting okay. And then I've been pretty regular. And, you know, really, I think it's gotten better every season so far.
Well, it was like right after Winter Soldier that it really took a turn. But it's also, it's kind of, its story has changed a lot since the beginning of that show.
Right. And I am kind of flabbergasted, especially, you know, of course, they would not, I don't know how they would have done it, but how did they not mention the snap? Because they, you know, in their current continuity, they would be post-snap, and they, you know, they'll be done before everybody comes back. You know, so what? Nobody in S.H.I.E.L.D. disappeared. Nobody in their, none of their families, doesn't affect them.
Weren't they in the future during the time of the snap anyways?
Oh, good point. You know, most of them would have been. So, yeah, how do you get snapped if you're already in the future? But so I guess it would have been all the support staff that they left behind or what. Well, you know, they now that they're back up and running, you see all these people running around in the background who they didn't have before. So,
right. And you're right. At the very least, it seems like that should be like a side conversation somewhere just to kind of tie everything in. But at the same time, I mean, they spent right. I'm somewhat caught up about seven episodes behind from whatever the newest is. But it's there. You have half the team out in space, and then you have the other team on the ground, you know, and apparently they keep talking about it, and maybe it's just the fact of it's been a while since the last season, but what is that they're not supposed to be there because they went back in time and changed things or something. So it's, I don't know. It's hard to tell what's going on right now.
Oh, that would be an interesting point that they've established, that you can go back and set up a new timeline, but, you know, you might have the perception you would be in the new timeline, but the old timeline would still exist. So maybe the old timeline is the one with the snap, and for some reason, the new timeline that they created by changing history, there was no snap.
And by doing that, they might be able to sum up the show the way they wanted to sum it up in the last two seasons.
Are they ending Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.?
Yeah, apparently it's not the end of this season, but the next season is supposed to be the last one.
It's like Supernatural. You know, they've announced it's canceled, but it's canceled at the end of next season.
That's another one. Jesus. You think about where that one has gone.
Well, I mean, you know, and I am not terribly religious. I consider myself a believer, but, you know, like I think Joe pointed out, the show that I missed, you know, on the new Sabrina, they, you know, they're actually saying Hail Satan and things like that. You know, that's going, you know, a certain part of the audience is not going to be up for that. And, you know, if you're caught up with Supernatural at the end of this season, you know, several seasons ago when they made the Angels not such good people all the time, I figured, okay, yeah, you're just saying goodbye to good, you know, some part of your audience. Maybe not ever. They figure people who watch that show aren't going to, you know, I am not so terribly offended. But at the, you know, the end of this season, they said, you know, God's sort of a jerk too. That's the show saying that. It's not me saying that. You know, I said, wow. You know, if there's anybody religious still watching that show, they just, you know, they just left.
See, I was wondering whether the end of this last season was going to be the end of Supernatural, because the only thing they were missing was you take the 500 on the left, you take the 500 on the right, I'll go up the middle. I always wanted to take on a dragon. That's the only thing that they were missing at the end of that season.
Oh, man. I agree with you there. It's kind of what I was thinking, too.
That basically, if they added a little line like that, they could have ended it off, in my opinion.
Well, I'm thinking they're going to bring the kid back. That's my prediction, somehow.
Remind me what happened to him?
Well, when Deed wouldn't shoot him, God, you know, zapped him.
Oh, right. Wasn't Satan waking up, too?
No, I think they destroyed Satan. A couple episodes, remember the kid, the Satan was going on a roll and the kid destroyed him.
Well, no, the his host was trying to resurrect Lucifer or pull Lucifer out of the nothing. And then, the kid killed the dude who was the host. And then, but that sent that all that did was close it so that Lucifer couldn't come back out or whatever. But I thought it showed, so at some point it showed Lucifer awake and the nothing again or something.
Okay, I interpret it as he's at both of them, but I could be terribly wrong.
But you think about like where they started off in that first season, where like demons were a big deal. Up until the point where they got like that demon knife, and that kind of changed everything. And then, you know, they got those knives or whatever from the angel, the angel knives, and that just changed everything, because they had a ton of those after that. And killing demons was never a big deal anymore, and demons were never a big deal anymore.
Well, I mean, you know, the first season they tried to save people if you could get through the whole chant. You know, if the body wasn't, you know, of course the way they went with most of that, well, most of your demons, you know, they get shot or jump off a cliff or some darn thing. And, you know, even if you remove the demon from the host body's going to die anyway. So it really does, you know, that's kind of the way they, you know, it doesn't make any difference. But I mean, yeah, they kind of went kind of bloodthirsty after the first season. Ah, yeah, we got the demon blade, or we've got the cult, you know, we'll just kill him.
Still a good show. It's been
always been one of my favorites. Obviously, they've decided, yeah, we're kind of running out of ideas here.
Right?
Better. I mean, it's been 12 seasons?
I think more than that.
15 seasons. Well, the upcoming one that starts in October will be season 15.
I don't think there's anything.
Yeah, because you go back and look at the, you know, a clip from the first season. Man, they look so young compared. I mean, it's not. Hell, they both look a lot better than me. But you know, you can definitely tell.
Right, and I think with that show, I think they've hit a point where there is nothing left that they can do, anyways.
Well, I mean, you know, they've made God a bad guy. How do you go past that?
Well, you had God, you have God's sister already, you had alternate reality, I mean, alternate dimensions. I mean, where else do you go?
Well, yeah, and I do think God's sister will come back next season to be the protagonist. It's like, you know, learn maybe that, you know, these humans aren't so bad and not, because you know, I can't think of who are they going to get to battle God.
I don't know, and that's kind of why I thought that basically the end of this past season would have been just the end.
Right. I mean, I don't know if I wouldn't want to end it exactly the way where they were, but, you know, Armageddon with absolutely no hope.
They could get that that gunfighter from Preacher. Doesn't he kill God in the comics?
So what is it, the Saint of All Killers?
Yeah, that guy. That'd be a weird crossover.
How did
That's one that's still in my cache. I haven't started yet as Preacher. I want to watch that on Hulu.
I love the comic books for that, but I started watching the first season of the show, and it was very slow moving. I had a hard time getting into it. And good evening, Fweeb.
Yeah, I'd say long time no see, but apparently that's not allowed anymore.
Hello. Hopefully the audio works
perfectly.
Hey, Fweeb, maybe we can have you host the show?
I suppose. I was hoping it already started. I just sort of slipped in, but I guess I didn't. I came in at the exact inopportune time.
No, that's okay. But before we start, I did want to interject a couple completely non sequitur things. The first one is anybody planning to head to Nevada in September?
What, you mean the Rush Area 51?
Okay, good. I'm glad I'm not the only one who saw that.
Oh, it's one of the downsides of most of my staff, 90% of my staff being under 30.
Okay, to explain this, apparently there is this push out on the web and people signing up, and supposedly they've got like a million signatures, that on September 20th, because reasons, that the American people need to know if there's aliens or not, that supposedly a million people are going to show up at Area 51 and just rush in and take over the place.
That's the gist of it, yes. But it's everything, all the memes around it are just absolutely hilarious, especially once I have my 25-year-old staff explain some of them to me.
I guess I've been out for a while. I haven't heard anything about this.
Yep.
As far as memes, there's a channel I follow. It's all you need to look for on YouTube is MXR, Montana X-Ray, Romeo. It's like MXR games, but it's this guy and his girlfriend, and they talk about things. But one, you know, I did one here. I think one of the most recent ones is all the memes on the internet thing. And they're just hilarious. I got into it because, we're a family show, but he also posts some lewd Skyrim mods, of which are many. So I watched a couple of those, and there's, you know, then there's ones with him just with his girlfriend on and, you know, and showing things on the internet that are ridiculous and laughing about it. And they actually started doing some, or they haven't done it in a while, but I went back or YouTube went back, you know, because YouTube you start watching a channel and then YouTube finds stuff and digs it up. But they've done a lot of cooking things too. Some of them are like, you know, cooking things from sci-fi, like, you know, they did butterbeer on one or something, and I guess there's a whole cookbook for the post-apocalyptic game I'm trying to think of that's out there, and they've done stuff off of that, and then they've done since the girl's Korean, that, you know, they've actually done some traditional Korean stuff that I really want to try. So, you know, but all that's non sequitur, but, you know, just like the one of the last things they've done is it is the Area 51 memes, and there's just some hilarious stuff out there.
Yeah, some new phrases I learned. Well, not new phrases, new things I learned was called, one thing was called Naruto running, which is apparently running with your arms behind your back. They're supposed to be one of the first people to charge in, and after them was supposed to be the Karens. Apparently, they people have an idea that any time that you see somebody up in a store complaining, it's usually some small, short-haired woman named Karen who was always complaining and wanting to see the manager. So they said that after the Naruto runners, they're sending in the Karens.
Yeah, I'm just giggling here.
I think there were other ones, but I think the furries were supposed to be one of the frontliners too.
And here, we thought he was just going to jump into a regular show.
It's been too long.
Okay, well, if that my second thing, it's far more normal. Did anybody get anything cool on Amazon Day?
Nope. I didn't see anything on Prime Day that was worth getting.
I got, what's it called? I got Fire tablet for my son, because I really, the free time on there, I thought, because my daughter, my parents had gotten my daughter a tablet about a little over a year ago, actually it'll be 2 years now, coming up on our birthday, and I found that if you want to get a tablet for a kid, it seems to be the best one. I tried just getting him a regular Amazon tablet and going, all right, I'll just kind of find some stuff to put on here. It is really difficult to go through the Play Store and find anything good for kids, because everything has some sort of either ad or paywall to it. So, like, he would do, like, three puzzles, the next thing you know, there's an ad for another game, and he doesn't know any better, and so he's hitting the thing for the ad. Obviously, he can't install anything, but he gets frustrated that now, you know, it's starting up another puzzle game or whatever is nothing more than an ad for something else. The good thing about free time on the Amazon Fire, the Kindle Fires, is free time is basically, it's all the... all the games, all the apps are free, and they're all basically completely unlocked and stuff. So if he wants to find something and play it, he can just install it, play it, or we can install it for him, and he can just play it and not get stuck with a bunch of ads for things and have him get frustrated. The other thing was I got another Echo Dot. And I got another one, and they had the deal where if you get it, it was like $22, and I added another plug for like $5. So we're going to put an Echo Dot upstairs so that the kids have something that the kids can use that. And I want to add the plug down here because I still want to do use No Red to do Wake on LAN for this computer that I'm running Mumble on, and have it set something up where I can just say, hey, I'm going downstairs or something like that, and have it turn on this computer and have it turn on I wanted to run my lights. This past New Year's, I'd gotten these, the strip LED lights that run all along my computer table here, so I'm gonna have it set up with that. I love to have it set up like a whole like scene where it'll do the computer and the lights at the same time. Besides those, I know we had gotten some other stuff, but none of it was really Prime Day. I did see one thing that I kind of wanted to get. I kind of stared at and drooled at was an external 8 terabyte drive for $119, regular $139. I stared at that for a while. I didn't buy it, but I really wanted to.
Now, before Prime Day, I did get an Echo Input, which you might want to check out. It's basically an Echo Dot, except it has no speaker of its own. You have to hook it to a Bluetooth speaker or an aux speaker.
Yeah, I saw those.
I'm glad you brought up the Dot, because I've got one. It was given to me, but I don't know what to do with it. I mean... is there anything you can do with it without having to connect to Amazon servers?
Not really.
You pretty much have to connect to Amazon servers.
It's got to be connected to the internet to turn your lights on and off.
Yeah, I didn't know if there was some kind of homebrew you could put on it just to install a tiny web server or something and have some kind of speech recognition.
Well, trouble with speech recognition is you really need a more powerful computer to run it.
Well, that and plus with the speech recognition, what are you going to do with it besides possibly, like he was saying, about turning on and off the lights?
Yeah, I was hoping that there was something I could do with it without it being connected to another, you know, to not my server.
I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if something out there that leverages the hardware, but I would think probably first there would be somebody writing code to use a Google device at home. The trouble is you know, most people need a more powerful computer than what they have in their house to even do speech recognition. And we talked about that, you know, there was one project out there. And go back a couple months, but looks like they've gone proprietary and are doing speech recognition for banks or whatever. You know, like I said, this was about three PenguinCons ago when they showed up and they said, like, yeah, you can do this in your house. You need at least like an i5 dedicated to speech recognition. At the time, you know, that was a fiscal impossibility. Now, you know, when you get an i5 for $200, yeah, you could do that.
Yeah, and I'm not sure if you saw in the Mumble Chat, but Jay Rula put something in there about Blather, and Blather is a really good project. And if check on Hacker Public Radio, probably do a search for Blather on Hacker Public Radio, and I am blanking on the guy who did a bunch of how to set up and use Blather stuff, episodes.
I'll think of it. I know you, but the trouble with Blather is that you have to go in and train it.
Yes. Well, yeah. I mean, yeah. Thank you, Jay. John Culp is the one who did all of the episodes on Blather. He's did a lot of work, episodes on how he set it up and how he used it.
You know, the difference between, say, you know, you using like Google Home or Echo or whatever is you can just, I said Echo and it responded. But you know, It's they send it out to a more powerful network on the web, and whatever you say to it, it'll come. It will try to interpret it at least. With Blather, you know, it's all key phrases. You know, like, you know, Blather, bring up Netflix. Blather, turn on the lights, and. You know, you have to say that exact same thing. It's not like "Hello, Mr. Computer," like the Google Home and the Echo and whatever and Mycroft would be. Still a great tool, but I mean, it's, you know, it's if you want to do things by voice, but like, you gotta preset up the commands.
Right.
Now what I got, and probably laziness on my part, you know, when I set up the network in this house, I had the builders run Ethernet to like the four corners and another one by the door. Because, you know, I wanted to drop out and have IP cameras all the way around the house because of course this is a berm house. I can really only see out one side. If I go around the door, I can look through the peephole that I made, that I installed, and I can look out that. Otherwise, that direction, I can go out to the garage. So, you know, only good view out one side, half of view out, you know, the other side. The other two sides are up against dirt, so no. And, you know, I was thinking about this when we built the house, and, you know, so, you know, I had the builders run all the cables through the Ethernet cables through the walls, but, you know, I did the termination on both ends. But, and I've had IP cameras, well, it is from, I think, last Amazon day. Someone suggested, yeah, these are great IP cameras. So I bought five. They're still sitting there in the box. Part of it is that I expected, you know, when I moved in the house, you know, these corners of the house, there would be an IP cable dangling and I'd be able to hook into it. And on the other end, hook in power over Ethernet and plumb it all in. And I think only one of them, they actually punched a hole and brought it outside, and the rest of them are all there, but it's like I have to go up in the attic and swim through insulation to find the cable and then make my own hole and all that. And I should have done that. Haven't done it. So I bought the security camera package from Amazon that, you know, that goes with all their Amazon devices, their Echo devices. So, and I was going to repurpose one of my Echoes that I had, and I probably should have still done, but, you know, I saw, you know, Echo Sticks, you know, $14. So, yeah, okay, fine. I'll spend another $14 and get a new stick. And I've got essentially two TVs in one room. You know, the one room was made to be both the living room and the dining room. And like I said, the builder convinced me to put an interface on every wall that you might want a TV. So I've got a TV hanging on a wall in the quote dining room that I never use. So I've always said that, you know, that would be the one that I would use to throw all the cameras up on. So I'm hoping when I get this package of five stick on cameras, they're battery powered and Wi-Fi. And then, you know, Fire Stick plugged into the TV and control. Finally, I will have a thing that, you know, shows all four directions out from my house, and, you know, another one to show me who's coming up to the door. So that's where I spent my money on Prime Day. And it won't be as good as the IP cameras, because IP cameras, you know, they are gimbaled and whatever. I can redirect them or whatever. And they're also infrared, so they actually work at night. I don't think these ones that I've got coming in are going to be any good in the dark. So I have to put up a big light or something, you know, if I want to see what's going on outside the house. But that's just been one thing I've been, you know, concerned about. I don't want to say paranoid, you know, things, you know, entirely in the realm of possibility. Somebody could come in the middle of the night, want to rob me or something like that. you know, or just in general, being able to see all four directions out of the house like any normal person. So, that's, you know, that's where I spent my money.
Now, just out of curiosity, do you have like a driveway going up to your house, like one that comes straight from the road?
Yes.
Have you ever thought about putting one of those, it's like a light sensor, so that like if anybody comes up the drive, like any vehicles come up the driveway, it like sets a little alarm in the house, or like a beep?
Oh yeah, I've definitely, of course, trouble's out by the road. There's no power source. You'd have battery or put up a solar panel or something, but definitely, in fact, well, like, you know, all the storage for this stuff, Echo stuff is online, not local, unfortunately. And I do have a camera that, but it, again, it was something that was available on, Black Friday, you know, from Walmart. All the storage on it is online. I need to go back in, but I'm sure the battery is probably dead on it, and it's an oddball battery. But yeah, I do have a camera pointing at, you know, where people would have to come in. That was at least at one time connected to the internet. Now it didn't. Well, actually, it would give me alerts on the phone for movement. You know, if the cattle and stuff, that was probably, you know, kind of annoyingly often. But yes, that's something I've considered more, not like a beam, but maybe a magnetic trip thing, anything of any size, metal of any size goes across it. And those are, you know, surprisingly inexpensive. I mean, you can get like a magnetic sensor like that for like a couple bucks.
Really? You're right. A magnet would be a lot more beneficial, because then like every time a critter walked past and broke the beam, you know, it wouldn't be setting off the alarm.
Exactly. And, you know, there are municipalities, I think, are incorporating this into their, parking lot, or not parking, but, you know, street parking systems, where you would have, you know, either have a time limit or you would have a parking meter, whatever. And rather having somebody constantly roaming around, you know, and marking tires or whatever, you know, you would have the central computer system saying, you know, far, far more efficient, less people. Yeah. This person's been here too long. Go here and give them a fine.
I can see that.
And the word I think I'm looking for is magnetometer, but yeah. And of course, incorporating it into the software and whatever, but you know, the raw hardware is cheap.
I'd be interested to see how that's set up.
Yeah, well, definitely I'll do a show on it, HPR or something, if I ever get anything like I want it to be. But yeah, because that's. And, you know, you would want something to hit your phone if you're away from the house and somebody went through the portal and, you know, and take a picture and say, do I recognize that vehicle or do I need to call the sheriff's office? And if you listen to Tilt, Rich is working, you know. He wants to do something that will read license plates. And I'm thinking it'd be a lot easier to send, you know, put something in every vehicle you own that, you know, broadcast, Yeah, I'm okay.
Well, that's kind of what he wanted to do originally, wasn't it? With, well, not necessarily. He wanted to do something with the involving Bluetooth, anytime one of the phones came onto the network or there was Bluetooth sensors through from like around the gate or whatever, so they knew he knew who was coming through. And apparently their Bluetooth is being used in the vehicles as well to check the tire pressure and whatnot. He wanted to sniff out that Bluetooth to tell whether what was coming up the driveway or who was coming through the driveway. But I think he realized that the frequency, he was getting too much interference with the frequency on the Bluetooth.
Okay, because I know there are a lot of locks or whatever that, you know, that will work with Bluetooth on your phone. So that if you walk up to the door, it'll just unlock.
Well, I think they've several things between NFC, and I'm sure you can set something up when, like, I think one of the things that he had either talked about or he set up where, you know, if you're close enough to the Wi-Fi in your house and you automatically connect to the Wi-Fi and it shows that you're on the network, you then have the ability, either it does it automatically or you have the ability to open up one of the doors.
Well, see, I'm the stupid idiot that got the RFID chip put into my hand, and it's the hobbyist one, and it's not compatible with any of the door locks that are out there.
The security software I'll be talking about when we start the show does, with help of a plugin, it does license plate recognition, and then it can alert you via the script what exactly the license plate says, or export to a text file too.
Right. And what I like about that, and maybe the web tie-in wouldn't be so terribly hard, you know, if, if something happens and they find me laying in a bud or whatever, that, you know, 24 hours later, the sheriff gets an email, you know, saying, yeah, here's a picture of the car and the license plate. Wouldn't do me a whole lot of good. And listeners, I am not this paranoid guy who thinks this is going to happen. It's just that it's not unheard of, might happen. I am in a very, very safe location compared to a lot of the country as far as things happening.
So one of the things that Jay Rule had put in the chat here was, I think if you have good enough camera, the license plate scanning would work well enough. I think the trick, again, is that it has to go to an untrusted cloud to get the project working. From one of the things that I know Rich was said that he was working on is you need definitely a more beefy machine, because one of the things he wanted to put it on was like an SBC, but you need something stronger than an SBC to run the license plate, because I think it's the same type of software they use for like facial recognition, so the license plate recognition stuff.
Oh, on that, I figured out the reason that I hadn't got my hat for the Adam Pies. I'd never actually pressed order, so I actually expected that to show up today, and it didn't. So by next show, hopefully I'll have a working Adam Pie here.
There's a license plate reader
Adam,
called
Adam Pie. Yeah, where have you been, that miner? There is an Adam Pie that is it's an Intel Atom processor.
Atomic.
Much cheaper than the high end 4 gig Raspberry Pi 4.
That wasn't that Atomic?
Atomic Pi. But it's an Atom processor. Hence the name. So it's like the lowest end, you know, Intel, but, you know, I'm going to be interested to see how it compares to, what's the Intel one that Rich has?
I don't know, but I got myself a Nook, and I am loving it.
I got the gigabit bricks. It's pretty good, but I'd like to at least compare it to the Pi 4. I've heard a lot of people say that it really does hit that low-end desktop build.
Upboard, that's what I was thinking of that Rich has. But yeah, the upboards are around $70 or over $70. The Atom Pi, I spent over $40 when I bought it, or Atomic Pi. But now you could start right out with it, but there is no, you know, traditional power port on it. You would have to, get a couple jumpers on the I/O ports, which I think are pretty sure are identical to the 40 port on the Raspberry Pi. So you'd have to take a power supply and either run it through an adapter or just clip the wires and solder on jumper wires and you know. So what it was intended to do, and I think these things were originally intended to be, you know, actually embedded systems. They weren't really intended at first to be released as a personal PC, you know, something for the home user to use. But there like a daughter board that you can plug in, and that has either or a barrel connector or a USB power connector, and the kits, they come, you know, then they come with a power supply that you can plug in and all that. So I do have that coming.
So Jay Rulo also put in the chat, it said, without EMMC, the Pi 4 seems too little too late. Has anyone tried, something like the difference between the EMMC and like a really good SD card in some of these things?
Well, you're always going to have problems with an SD card. My interest would be a really good USB 3.0 hard drive and something like Berry Boot. If you could get Berry Boot to work on the Pi 4 and then run your operating system off the hard drive. Now, eventually they are supposed to also get firmware to allow it to boot directly from USB, so that'll be another thing entirely.
And like I said last show, you know, it's probably not fair to test and compare any of these things for about 6 months until the software is optimized.
I tried that on my Rock Pro 64, booting and running from an SD card versus the EMMC module, and it was pretty significant difference as far as speed goes, doing speed tests, read-write tests. And the actual boot up time, I didn't really notice because it was so fast anyway, but read and write, it's a pretty big difference.
Okay.
And then for my storage, I have on the Rock Pro 64, there's a PCI slot on there that you can put a card in, and I put an NVMe card in there, and that's what I'm using for storage. And that's really fast too, compared to how I had it hooked up to a just a spinning disk drive.
Are you getting like full speeds with that? Have you done any testing? Are you getting full NVMe speeds?
I haven't tested read and write on the NVMe drive. I have tested, as far as like, pulling files down natively and uploading files, you know, through Ethernet, and it's faster than what I was getting with the hard drive. The hard drive was hooked up via USB 3 and the PCIe slot seems to be faster. Now, because it's going through there and not a native NVMe port, or you know, plug-in that you would have on a regular motherboard, you're going to lose some speed there as well. But I think I already had this drive, so I went ahead and bought the board, and it was, you know, $10 or something like that. It was worth it.
Cool. Well, the nicest thing about Raspberry Pi isn't actually the hardware, though. It's the community. The fact that, you know, nothing runs on it right now, you give it 6 months, and basically you'll have everything running on it again, and we'll be seeing these insane amount of projects attached to it.
Right, I was just about to say that, too.
Yeah, and even though spec-wise you compare the Raspberry Pi to another board, and the other board on paper looks like it blows it away. But you hook up the Raspberry Pi and you run a browser, and everything looks, you know, everything scrolls okay, and you can, you know, you go to YouTube or whatever. You know, I'm surprised. A lot of people said, yeah, you know, you couldn't run YouTube before Raspberry Pi 4. And I was thinking, well, I've been doing it fine back to 2. But, and then you go to this computer with way, way better specs, and, and you load a web page and you try to scroll up and down and it hangs, you know, and like you guys said, it's all the community. There's a lot of community behind Raspberry Pi, whereas all these disparate projects that, you know, on paper have better specs, but there's nobody working there to optimize the software, and, you know, sometimes things just don't work and there's nobody there to fix it.
Yeah, I have some input on Raspberry Pi storage. With USB 3, you can actually get reasonably fast SSD attachment either through a standard USB 3 to SATA connector or through there actually a SSD in a flash drive form factor.
One last quick little thing before we hopefully start the show. I was on my Fire Stick today and I thought I saw something that you can get native YouTube on Amazon now on the Fire. It was my understanding that since YouTube was a Google product that they didn't want to share, but thought I saw that on the home screen of my, I got one down here on a tiny little television, and I don't see anything on that, but I thought I saw it on the one upstairs. Okay, I just found an article about it, something from The Verge. I'll see if I can get a link to it. It says, YouTube is finally coming back to Amazon Fire TV devices. All right, so do you want to start the show?
I'm ready.
Sure, I've been voluntold.
You can if you want to.
Oh, we'll see how much we miss me mispronouncing and stumbling over everything. It'll be great.
If it helps, I shortened the intro.
let's just wing it then. It'll be great.
It's not what I do.
SMLR 2.0 is the revamped Sunday Morning Linux Review with Tony Bemis, Mary Tomich, and Tom Lawrence. On even episodes, we cover distro fever and tech news. On the odd episodes will be fresh looks where we review a distro or software or tips and tricks. Live recordings are bi-weekly. Sunday morning on both Google Hangouts on air and audio only stream. Visit smlr.us for all the shows and the live recording schedule.
Oh my God, it's Hacker
Public Radio.
Hacker Public Radio is a daily podcast by the hacker community for the hacker community. If you're interested in technology, creative thinking, hacking, Linux, or any kind of computer, that kind of stuff, you should listen to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.com.
The Linux Link Tech Show. Tune in to the world's longest-running Linux podcast live every Wednesday, 8:30 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Find us on the web at www.twlts.org or email us at techshow@thelinuxlink.net. IRC server, thelinuxlink.net /techshow. Join Pat, Alan, Link, and Joel. And don't forget the two Dans. They are so hot. I know, because I've kissed them both. And Flying Rich, he's a bloody drunk.
If you don't like a gas, you can get up your ass. Ain't no funny duddies, and I'll get back.